If we're to examine the influence of the Schuberts on music, the first thing we have to do is define our terms. Briefly, there were four Schuberts who mattered. The first one was called Franz, and he wrote this. That piece of music by Franz Schubert is called The Unfinished Symphony. But our program is about the other three Schuberts, Lee, Sam, and J.J. And the best way of defining them is to say that if they'd been around when Franz wrote The Unfinished Symphony, they wouldn't have paid him until he did finish it, and probably not even then. Apart from the fact that Franz wrote music and the Schubert brothers packaged it, there's no connection between them. And as a matter of fact, they couldn't even spell the name properly because they always left out the C. So it's some tribute to Lee, Sam, and J.J. that although they didn't know the difference between a French horn and a Brussels sprout, they do sometimes get confused with old Franz. Now, I think the best way of approaching the bewildering tangle of the three Schubert brothers' career in showbiz is to regard it all as a riotous comedy. A comedy that we can enjoy because we didn't have to tangle with the brothers. Time has distanced us from the chicaneries of the bad old days so that we can sit back and revel in the extraordinary ingenuity that the Schuberts brought to their task of trying to corner the market in money. It's impossible to discuss, even in passing, all their productions because there were over 500 of them. Their fortune was estimated at one time as $500 million, and that's not counting the small change. And if there was one thing the Schuberts always did, it was count the small change. Some of their shows featured some of the most popular music of this century. For instance, this.
Though you get D-, it isn't all.
Student Prince, composed by Sigmund Romberg. And later on, we'll see exactly what Romberg got out of that experience. Then there was this.
Pardon me, pretty baby. Is it yes, is it no, is it maybe? Pardon me, pretty baby. Don't I look familiar to you? Oh, come on, get acquainted. There's a bench in the park, newly painted. Great idea, honey, ain't it? Well, at least it's something to do.
Pardon me, pretty baby, a phrase coined by the lyricist Gus Kahn. And here's another epigrammatic phrase introduced in a Schubert show.
I'm forever blowing bubbles, pretty bubbles in the air. They fly so high, nearly reach the sky. Then like my dreams, they fade and die. Fortune's always hiding. I've looked everywhere. I'm forever blowing bubbles, pretty bubbles in the air.
Now, clearly the showman who could manage for over half a century to give the public such tuneful memories, clearly such men are remembered with affection by all whose paths they crossed. So let's begin with the testimony of the grand old man of theatre criticism, Brooks Atkinson, who sums up all his experience to encapsulate the particular merits of the Schubert productions, that distinctive bouquet which has rendered them immortal.
Well, the Schuberts put on junk shows. They never had much style.
Further tributes come from Larry Adler, who worked for the Schuberts back in the early 1930s.
I don't think anybody really adored the Schuberts. They always tried to cut costs, to cut salaries, and in fact, we opened in Boston the way I had with Ziegfeld and Smiles, and within a week, Schuberts were asking the cast to take cuts. Now, I was getting a pretty damn small salary anyway, and I refused to cut, so again, that put me on the outs with the Schuberts as well. So our relationship was never happy. Ziegfeld called me, "Hey, you." I don't think I even got as far as that with the Schuberts. I was just, as far as Lee or Jake Schubert were concerned. And they had a kind of disregard for people. They didn't care about people's feelings or their self-respect or anything else. I didn't like them.
One of the earliest formulas the Schuberts adopted for selling tickets wasn't very original, but it was very effective. Gilbert and Sullivan. By now, the days had long since gone when American showmen, protected by the absence of a copyright agreement between Britain and America, could stage the Savoy operas without being obliged to pay royalties to anyone but themselves, but the Schubert brothers found that Gilbert and Sullivan still meant handsome profits. As a matter of fact, the Schuberts retained their faith in Gilbert and Sullivan for nearly half a century.
Never mind the why and wherefore. levels of the level ranks, and therefore, though his lordship's taste is mighty, though to penalty is great, though her tastes are mean and flighty, and her fortune poor and lame, there is very well the lordship's friend here before the plan, for the union of his lordship with a humble captain's son, for a humble captain's daughter,
for a gallant captain's daughter,
and a lord who rules the water,
and a tall mountain porter.
Get there with joy, me lady, bring us on the air above, for the union, for the maiden, with a man who wants her love. Never mind the why and wherefore, love can level ranks on their bond, though your nautical relation in my secrets can't be passed, though you occupy a station in the low middle class. And a lord who rules the water,
and
the tall mountain
water.
Let's hear the joy of the little princess of the air above, for the union of the little wheeler men.
The music of Gilbert and Sullivan, who disliked each other almost as much as everybody disliked the Schuberts, and quite as much as the Schuberts evidently disliked each other. They were always paying tributes to each other, like the one Brooks Atkinson describes.
Strangely enough, they lived on opposite sides of the street. Lee was on the north side of 44th Street, and J.J. was on the south side, and they didn't speak. That's what I'm told. But they must have spoken. After all, there's a lot of money involved.
Partners who called their employees Hey You and each other Nothing at All. Already the portrait begins to form of the warm-hearted, art-loving showbiz myth. The impression is substantiated by master lyricist Johnny Mercer.
They were always cutting corners, cutting expenses. The joke about the Schuberts was that they used the scenery from the last show for the new show. They just changed the titles. They ran their theaters like a dime store. You know, as long as they had something in it, they were happy. They didn't care how good it was.
Or how bad. However, their flirtation with the musical Orient was a conventional enough ploy. Ever since the success of the Mikado, China and Japan had been considered box office insurance by impresarios who had never been further east than Coney Island. In 1896, Broadway had welcomed an English piece by Lionel Monckton and Sidney Jones called The Geisha, starring, of all people, Isadora Duncan. And as the Edwardian audiences continued to show their taste for bogus, oriental, exotic effects, so did the Schuberts by reviving The Geisha.
China man, no money makey, all her life be long. Washy, washy, wants me takey, washy, washy, wrong. When me think he steal he call us, please see money come. Me get finey $5, plenty muchy sum. Chin, chin, Chinaman, muchy, muchy sad. Me a played, all a played, welly, welly bad. No he joke, brokey bloke, make he shutty shop. Chin, chin, Chinaman, chop, chop, chop.
Chin, chin, Chinaman, muchy, muchy sad. Me a played, all a played. Belly, belly, bad. No, he joke, brokey, broke, makey, shanty, shop. Chin, chin, Chinaman, chop, chop, chop.
When me getty catchy cheaty playy PC car, Chinaman they all o beaty kicky welly hard. When me takey nicey placey makey plenty tea, getty me in more disgracey up they selly me. Chin chin Chinaman, muchy muchy sad. Me a played all o played welly welly bad. No e joke, blokey bloke, makey shutty shop. Chin chin Chinaman, chop chop chop.
Chin chin Chinaman, muchy muchy sad. Me afraid, all afraid, welly welly bad. No e joke, blokey bloke, makey shutty shop.
Chin chin Chinaman, chop chop chop.
Not all the songs in that show were as intellectually distinguished as that one. The biggest hit of the show, the one that survived to this very day, was this.
A goldfish swam in a big glass bowl, as dear little goldfish do. But she loved with the whole of her heart and soul an officer brave from the ocean wave, and she thought that he loved her too. A small inside daily fed with crumbs of the best digestive bread. This kind attention proves that she how exceedingly fond is.
The Schubert statistics sound more like Standard Oil or the great cattle barons. 520 productions, ownership of hundreds of theatres, billions of dollars. In fact, more or less complete control over the commercial theatre in America at one time. And yet the beginnings were almost farcically small-time and almost farcically conventional. The immigrants from Europe, fleeing from the pogroms of Tsarist Russia, selling newspapers in the street, running errands for theatre managers, selling programmes and so on, until wriggling into management. Now, let's begin by establishing who the Schuberts were and when they were born. And a word of warning. The Schubert boys had a funny habit of covering their tracks, so it all gets a bit complicated. Well, here goes with the researches of a recent full-scale biography.
In the census of 1892, David the father was 46, Carrie the mother 43. Of the children, Fanny was 23, Sarah 20, Lee 19, Sam 16, Jacob 14, Dora 12.
So far, so good, but that's not very far after all. By 1893, a year after the census, things were beginning to switch round.
In 1893, Lee had become Sam's younger brother, and Sam had gained a year, while Lee had mysteriously lost two. Catherine had grown younger, and the entire family had stopped being born in Lithuania and had started being born in Syracuse, New York, instead.
Jacob now decided that not only was his date of birth unsatisfactory, and not only was his place of birth unsatisfactory, but also that his name wasn't quite right. There weren't enough J's in it.
Jacob decided to add another J to his name, therefore ceasing to be J. Schubert and becoming J.J. Schubert.
The only thing that he didn't change was his personality, but then you can't have everything. The Schubert boys, however, tried.
By 1905, 13 years later, the father would be 13 years older, but Carrie, the mother, only 8 years older.
Oh, perhaps she wasn't growing quite as fast as her husband. But what about the children? Well, they too were all proceeding at their own individual rates.
In the 13 years, Sarah had become 11 years older. And by a remarkable coincidence, so had J.J. Dora was 11 years older, but Sam now became 2 more years younger than before, and was the same age as Lee, who had now lost another 2 years. And while everyone else who had stopped being born in Lithuania had decided to remain born in Syracuse, Sam and Lee decided to get born somewhere else.
One begins to wonder what a psychiatrist would make of that mess. No wonder that the father was usually the worse for drink. So much so that Sam and Lee were the breadwinners when they were still 12 years old. Or 9, or 5, or whichever age they happened to feel like being. Now, gradually, they rose in the scheme of things, inching their way into the good books of the local theatre manager. And to give you an idea of the sort of popular music being written at the time by the younger rising composers, here's something that Jerome Kern, then completely unknown, was trying to sell at just about the same time the Schubert brothers were trying to sell themselves.
I don't know why I am so very shy. I always was demure.
I never knew what silly lovers do. No flirting I'd endure.
In all my life I'd never kissed a man.
I've never winked my eye.
But now at last I'm going to break the ice. So how do you like to try?
How'd you like to spoon with me? How'd you like to spoon with me? Sit beneath that oak tree large and shady, calling me a tootsie wootsie baby. How'd you like to hug and squeeze? Dangle me upon your knees. How'd you like to be my lovey-dovey? How'd you like to spoon with? How'd you like to spoon with? How'd you like to spoon with me?
How'd You Like to Spoon With Me? An early Jerome Kern song published about 1905, at the time when the Schubert brothers were first beginning to make their impact. Sam's methods were summed up by one writer as a soupçon of charm here, a dollop of shyness there, one pinch of greed everywhere. As for J.J., he was defined as 150 pounds of concentrated truculence, which seems a bit unfair as he only got involved in violence now and then. Lee tried to strangle him once in childhood and later tried to kill him again when he found J.J. trying to beat Sam's head through the floor. Just one big happy family. Inspired by their hero worship of the great David Belasco, they began theatrical speculating and soon came into the orbit of the Syndicate, a group of flesh-eating entrepreneurs whose idea of a magnanimous gesture was to throw another peasant on the fire. The Schuberts drifted into a running war with the Syndicate from the beginning of the century, but when they began, the Syndicate hadn't even heard of them. All the Schuberts were little fellows. The story goes that when the great actor-manager Richard Mansfield first met them, he thought that they were the office boys. If Lee stood on Sam's shoulders, they might have made one good basketball player, but there was nothing undersized about their ruthlessness. In 1900, they bought the touring rights to a Broadway hit whose romantic music is the perfect setting for the sweet and gentle personalities which we now know the Schubert boys possessed.
Schubert, we used to kid about him. We said he looked like a cigar store Indian. He was kind of almost mahogany color. He was kind of red-faced and very quiet and never smiled. Rather tall and wore Panama, seems to me, and smoked cigars. His brother, J.J., was short and fat, quite a handful, because he would fight with everybody. And they were always cutting corners, cutting expenses.
J. J.J. had nothing for the theater. He was strictly a money man. He contributed nothing to the theater.
Well, not exactly nothing. You could say that all the Schuberts brought a spirit of competition into the theater. And then you might put it in a rather different way. But however you put it, you can't get around the fact that the Schubert brothers came to monopolize the world of the American theater. The rate of progress is so fast that the facts tend to get a bit bewildering. However, here goes.
1900. The brothers produce a turkey called Arizona, which is so bad that everyone rushes to see it. Later that year, they produce another show called Sold and Paid For. Say the New York Reviews, nothing nearly as awful as this has been seen in 20 years. In 1901, the syndicate, masterminded by Abe Erlanger, now owns 95% of American theaters. But a year later, the Schuberts produce a show called Chinese Honeymoon with a hero called Sam Pineapple. It's a smash hit. With the profits, the Schuberts start to buy land, thus asserting the age-old right of all Americans to enjoy the fruits of liberty at the expense of all other Americans.
By 1902, Erlanger, seeing the Schuberts as rivals, offers to do a deal with them. Instead of taking 50% of all takings of their shows in his theatres, he will take only 25%. Touched by Erlanger's generous offer only to steal a quarter of their receipts instead of half, the Schubert boys hot up the battle. Something else hots up the battle, literally.
1903, Erlanger's showpiece theatre in Chicago burns down. 600 die in the panic. An Erlanger's group gets a bad name for unsafe theaters.
In April 1904, the Schubert brothers took out insurances on their lives and ran into all sorts of troubles in trying to decide how old they would be this time. Sam, who had been born in Poland and was 29, put down on the form that he was 26 and born in Syracuse. Lee, who was 31, put down 28, but it was Jacob who made the big boob. He went and put down his age as 25. Well, he was 25. Nobody knows how he came to make such a slip. Sam wrote down that he had three brothers and the two of them were now 30. Lee said he only had two brothers, but they must have been different ones from those Sam had in mind because Lee's were only 27 and 26. He also said that one of his sisters was 27, which meant that according to the children, poor Mama had had four confinements in 1 year. No wonder Father took to drink. Jacob reckoned he had two brothers aged 31 and 30, but gave the ages of his sisters as nil. By 1905, people were beginning to talk, and in the same year, the newspaper publicity was getting so bad that the Schuberts started their own paper called the show, which usually approved of everything the Schuberts said, including that their combined ages apparently added up to 314, and that most of them were 10 years old before they'd even been born. But then matters simplified themselves a little. Sam decided to take a trip in connection with some Schubert business that had to be finalized, and so, looking for the cleanest, safest, quickest way to get from A to B, he took the train.
We regret to report the death in a train smash of Sam Schubert, the well-known theatrical figure. He was 30 years of age, or 28, or 27. He is deeply mourned by his younger or older brothers.
When Sam died, Lee's spirit was shattered. But, obligingly, the syndicate kindly put it all back together again for him by being amazingly callous about it. Brooks Atkinson recalls.
It was out near Pittsburgh. There was a railroad accident and he was killed. And it was a terrible shock to Lee and I suppose J.J., although I never knew J.J. Lee went around to see Frohman. They had made some kind of a deal. And Lee asked Frohman to relinquish this deal they had with Belasco. And Frohman says, "I have no respect for a deal with a dead man." And Lee came out and he said, "We will get that son of a bitch." That's where the real rivalry began. It was murderous, and they won. The Schuberts won.
One of the other things that the Schuberts won was certain residual rights in their own chorus girls. As their biographer wrote, if they didn't invent the casting couch, they certainly developed its function. Now, around the time of Sam's death, Pulitzer's newspaper, The New York World, conducted a fascinating analysis of the Schubert girls in a musical called Lady Teazle. This was a modest little affair, an honest attempt to reflect in contemporary terms the wit and subtlety of Restoration drama. And to help reflect it, the Schuberts had hired 86 chorus girls. Of the 86 specimens of pure American maidenhood, 20 were married, 21 divorced, 6 currently being divorced, and the other 39 still conducting negotiations. On average, each girl worked 20 weeks a year for $18 a week, annual income $360. Annual income, $360, and yet 7 of them owned automobiles, 78 listed jewelry of furs as assets, 48 claimed something called independent means. The youngest of the 86 was 16 years old, and none of them was the oldest. When you look at the history of the emergent Schubert Empire, it is to find star names splashed all over the place. Bernhardt, Ada Rehan, Lillian Russell, Bernard Shaw. Somehow, the Schuberts got themselves involved with everyone, with financiers for assets to buy land to build theatres, with artists to create productions, with everyone and anyone who could further the Schubert cause. In 1907, the Supreme Court declared Erlanger's syndicate illegal, and from then on, the Schuberts gained ground. By then, they already owned 120 theatres, and in 1911 they acquired the services of an artist we all remember and still recognise instantly.
Oh, honey, honey, oh, honey, honey, just hear that bell. Oh, lovey, lovey, oh, lovey, lovey, that music is grand. Oh, sweetie, sweetie, oh, sweetie, sweetie, don't hesitate. I wanna dance, I just can't wait. Oh honey, just hold me tight, I'm dancing mad tonight. Snap your fingers and away you go. Snap your fingers and whistle low. Just throw your shoulders high. Just roll that roguish eye. Snap your fingers as you roll along. You can go wrong. Don't you leave me, honey. Don't you leave me now. Don't you leave me now. Don't you dare leave me now. Oh, oh, don't say no. Snap your fingers, away you go. Oh, lovey, lovey, oh, lovey, lovey, I'm dreaming that's all. Oh, sugar baby, oh, sugar baby, don't leave any call. Oh, honey, honey, oh, honey, honey, oh, me or more. I want it down, I want it down, I can't tell why. Oh, sweetie, oh, sweetie, now don't let's go until the rooster crow. Snap your fingers, away you go. Snap your fingers and whistle low. Just throw them shoulders high. Just roll that roguish eye. Snap your fingers as you roll along. You can go wrong. Don't you leave me, honey. Don't you leave me now. I said don't you leave me now. Don't you dare leave me now. Oh, oh, don't say no. Snap your fingers, away you go.
The Shuberts were cute enough to sign up Jolson to a watertight contract for the next 3 million years, but when they came to produce their next big extravaganza, they left Jolson out of it. The passing show of 1912 was the first of many annual editions, the Shuberts' answer to the Ziegfeld Follies. The Shuberts detested Ziegfeld. They had once lent him $1,000 boat fare from Europe to come home and sign a contract with them, and Flo, with his usual dud sense of humour, had gone and signed with Erlander instead. So, the passing show series was to be the big attempt to copy all Ziegfeld's ideas. The first edition had songs by Irving Berlin and Jerome Kern, but nothing memorable emerged apart from the profits. For several years after, the passing shows were a kind of constant backdrop to the machinations of Lee and J.J. Schubert. Slowly, the power of Erlanger and the syndicate was eroded, and the Schuberts moved in. There were lawsuits and breaches of contract, periodical renovations of the casting couches, battles with rival entrepreneurs, liberties taken with artists, and one memorable decision by J.J., who told a press conference that European drama was different from the American brand because it was more continental. Now, so far, everything about the passing shows was derivative, even down to the title, which had been coined by another producer back in 1894, when Lee was only 6, or 8, or 5, or 9. Anyway, the first time the passing show produced a hit of its own was in 1916.
Pardon me, pretty baby. Is it yes, is it no, is it maybe? Pardon me, pretty baby. Don't I look familiar to you? Oh, come on, get acquainted. There's a bench in the park newly painted. Great idea, honey, ain't it? Well, at least it's something to do. Was it summer when I met you? Was it underneath the moon? Was it foggy, foggy London? How could you forget so soon? By the way, how's your mother and your dad and your sis and your brother? Pardon me, who's another? Don't I look familiar to you?
Pardon Me, Pretty Baby turned up in the passing show of 1916. The bulk of the show was composed by Irving Berlin, but there were also a few odd numbers included by other writers. One of the additional songs had one of the most inscrutable titles in the entire popular catalogue, Yaki Hula Hiki Dula.
Down Hawaii away, where a cancer strayed, on an evening I heard a hula maiden say, yaka hula hiki doo la, yaka hula hiki doo. down Hawaii away by the moonlit bay. When I lingered a while, she stole my heart away. Yuck-a-lick-a-doo-la, yuck-a-lick-a-doo. Oh, I don't care if you love the ladies far and near. You'll forget about them all if you could hear. Yuck-a-lick-a-doo-la, yuck-a-lick-a-doo. I'm coming back to you, my hula-loo. Beside the sea at Waikiki, you'll play for me. And once again you'll sway my heart away with your yakahula hitty doola too. I'm coming back to you, my hula loo. Beside the sea at Waikiki, you're gonna play for me. And once again you'll sway my heart away with your yakahula.
Yaki Hula, Hickey Doola from the Schubert Brothers passing show of 1916. In the 1918 edition, all the big hits were lifted from earlier successes. The Schuberts were nothing if not cautious, and sometimes they were nothing and cautious, and in 1918 they followed their usual policy of guaranteeing their quota of hits by using them ready-made. As far back as 1913, they had been doing that in the passing show by lampooning other people's successes. Audiences then had been invited to laugh at this, for instance, without being told why they ought to laugh at it, except, of course, that the Schubert brothers wanted them to laugh. And when the Schuberts wanted you to laugh, you usually ended up laughing. Or crying. And this was the plagiarism of 1913.
There go my heart, I love you, don't let us part, I love you, I always knew it would be you. Since I heard your lilting laughter, it's your Irish heart I'm after. Pago my heart, your glances make my heart say, how's chances, come be my own, come make your home in my heart. Pago my heart, I love you, don't let us part, I love you, I always knew it would be you. Since I heard your lilting laughter, it's your Irish heart I'm after. Pago my heart, your glances make my heart say, how's chances, come be my own, come make your home in my heart.
Peg of My Heart was the kind of song to please the ticket holders of 1913, and 5 years later, the passing show had other interpolated hits. One of them was an unusually original melody which never quite repeated its opening strain and has survived to this day as a musical encapsulation of wartime sentiment.
There are smiles that make us happy. There are smiles that make us blue. There are smiles that steal away the teardrops as the sunbeams steal away the dew. There are smiles that have a tender meaning that the eyes of love alone may see. But the smiles that fill my heart with sunshine are the smiles that you give to me.
Soft and smooth.
There are smiles that make us happy. There are smiles that make us blue.
Now bring it out.
There are smiles.
clouds. But the smiles that fill my heart with sunshine are the smiles that you give to me.
When the passing show audiences of 1918 weren't singing along with that piece of whimsy, they could, if they wanted to, sing along with quite another piece of whimsy altogether. This alternative sold 2.5 million song copies, or one for every 5 people by now on the Schubert's payroll, so neither Lee nor J.J. were exactly taking a chance by including it in their production.
I'm forever blowing bubbles, pretty bubbles in the air. They fly so high, nearly reach the sky. Then like my dreams, they fade and die. Fortune's always hiding.
Pretty sentiments, suitable for the nursery, purveyed by the Schubert brothers, who had never been in a nursery because they were never quite sure how old they were. They grew up as the 20th century arrived. They came into a New York symbolized by vaudeville and the short stories of O. Henry, the musical bravura of George M. Cohan, and the iron fist in the iron glove of Abe Erlanger, whose habit of putting his hand inside his jacket whenever he stood up is generally thought to have indicated a Napoleon complex, but which the Schubert brothers firmly believed was because he was making sure his wallet was still there. By the end of the Great War, the Schuberts owned every theatre in America that was worth having, and, let's be frank, one or two that weren't worth having, too. The cinema was beginning to loom, and the dubious joys of old age were not so very far away. Before we pause and take a breath in preparation for our trail of the Schubert spoor through the musical comedy and operetta of the 1920s, it might be revealing to listen to what one outstanding American comic remembers about his apprenticeship with the Schuberts. The idea of Milton Berle singing Flora Dora might sound far-fetched, but it was the Schuberts who were selling it, so it was all right.
They were very, very tough. I have a story which goes back to 1920 when I was in a thing called the Floridora Sextet. Tell me, pretty maiden, are there any more at home like you? We were 12, 13 years old. I was a chorus boy, and I think they paid me $18 a week, which was all right for them, not for my mother. We all come out to Tell Me, Pretty Maiden. We walked out, 6 boys from one side and 6 girls from the other. My mother said to me, "What foot do you start on when you first come out?" I said, "I start on my left foot." She said, "Well, when you start to go out tonight, start on your right foot." I said, "But, Mom, I'll be out of step for the whole thing." She said, "Do as I say." So I started on my right foot. And, of course, I got all screwed up, you know. And I was only a child, and the audience were laughing because I was completely all out of step. We had to do about 4 encores, and it got hysterical. Kiddies, you know, making a mistake. My mother warned me. She said, "Now, when J.J. Schubert comes back and he says anything to you..." My mother always held my hand tightly. She said, "You'd say that you were nervous. Don't tell him that I told you to do it." Well, he did come back. The show was a hit. But he came back after the show and he said, "Where is that little boy? What's his name? Milton Berlinger." That's my right name, Berlinger. "Here I am, sir." He says, "Come over here." He said, "Now, you were out on the road with this show for 4 weeks. You rehearsed. What happened out there?" I said, "Well, I started to stumble and stand. I was so nervous." And I felt my mother's hand squeezing me and saying to herself, "I hope he says what I tell him to say. I was so nervous, I started out on my wrong foot." He said, "Yes, but you did it 3 times." Because we did encores. I said, "Well, I was stumbling." And my mother stepped in. She said, "You will have to forgive him, Mr. Schubert, because I was the hit of the show that night, even with all the stars, because it was ridiculous. This little child stole the show." Well, I thought he was going to say, "You're fired." But that's not what he did. He said to me one line. He says, "Can you do it every show?"
Tell me, pretty maiden, are there any more at home like you?
There are a few kind, sir, but simple girls and proper too.
Then tell me, pretty maiden, what these very simple girlies do?
They serve their
maiden, what these girlies do? Then take a little walk with me, and then I can see what a most particular girl should
be. I may love you too well to let you go and flirt with those at home you know.
Well, don't mind, little girl, you'll see. I'll only want but
you. Not quite fair to them if you told them that you were
I don't true. Care a pin for your sisters if you love me.
What would you say if I said I liked you well?
I bow to you.
On bended knee.
On bended knee.
If I love you, would you tell me what I ought to do to keep you all mine alone? Anything to do, for I must love someone.
Then why not me?
Yes, I must love someone, really, and it might as well be you.
Next week, we'll follow the Schubert brothers into more modern times as they fought to retain their stranglehold on the jugular vein of the American theater, tangling with the antitrust laws and every other management in an attempt to stay top dogs and not leave so much as a single bone for anyone else.
Well, as Michael has just said, you'll be able to hear how many bones became the exclusive property of the Schuberts next week. But meanwhile, Benny Green is going to provide a few forward glances at that particular program.
Well, after a catalogue like that, perhaps people might be excused for assuming that when it came to villainy, Lee and J.J. Schubert had shot their bolt. Not a bit of it. They were only warming up. As they got into their stride and bought up theatre after theatre, chain after chain, performer after performer, they became so egocentric that they wouldn't even speak to each other. They plagiarised other people's shows. They even copied their own. They would close a success and then announce a revival 5 minutes later. The success they enjoyed was staggering. Their weekly gross rose to $1 million, but still they weren't satisfied. And as they grew richer, so they grew more repulsive. I suppose it's predictable enough when their enemies say comically bitter things about them. You find that with every successful person. But what's so wonderful about Lee and JJ is that even the testimonies of their friends are frightening. People who are actually paying them a compliment brought home the truth of the brothers' villainy even more vividly than the enemies. For instance, there was once a successful songwriter called J. Fred Coots. Now, I don't know exactly what was wrong with J. Fred Coots, but he actually liked the Schubert brothers. He wrote several shows for them, and by a series of accidents, he got paid for the work. So he took a shine to both brothers. What J. Fred Coote specialised in for the Schuberts were shows with Paris in the title. There was, of course, nothing Parisian about them except the title, but this was New York in the 1920s, so who cared? And yet J. Fred Coote, when he's trying to tell posterity that it is, after all, possible to get along with people like the Schuberts, says worse things about them than if they'd rustled his grandmother.
I would say that they proceeded along a certain line of acrimony. They didn't think so much of happiness, but profits. All they were interested in were profits. There were some things about J.J. Schubert that was very nice. And Mr. Lee, he was very nice.
Except, of course, for the oil and the iodine he soaked into his face. That remark of Coote's, I would say they proceeded along certain lines of acrimony, is one of the immortal examples in this world of damning with faint praise. And what more fitting epitaph to be carved on the tombs of these two robber barons than Coote's hair-raising remark, they didn't think of happiness, but of profits. In next week's programme, the story of the Schuberts will drift from the ancient history of modern showbiz into its Middle Ages. We will learn about some of the shows that were so profitable and so successful that they're still with us to this day. Shows like Maytime, The Student Prince, The Merry Widow, Bittersweet. So the brothers must have had some kind of ability. They must at least have been shrewd at casting a show. On the contrary, JJ, who knew less than nothing about that kind of thing, never took his casting responsibilities much further than the nearest couch. And Lee was too busy smearing his face with the oil and not talking to JJ to bother too much about casting. According to the testimonies of people who were there at the time, Lee used to go for advice about the theatre to his barber. JJ preferred his chiropodist. It's all a bit bewildering, but child's play compared to the legal implications. The Schuberts were as much sued against as suing. Their favourite dress was the lawsuit. They used to transfer stock like jugglers sewing up hard-boiled eggs. There were paternity trials, breach of promise trials, divorces, settlings out of court, all kinds of skullduggery and sailing a little too close to the wind. But the shows themselves went on being produced. Schubert Productions poured out like screws off a production line. The costumes might remain the same, but the shows were different. Or at least the titles of the shows were different. And all that we can glean today in artistic terms from this billion-dollar act of piracy is the music. Next week, as Arthur Schwartz and Evelyn Leigh and Peggy Wood and Ben Oakland talk of the brothers, and as Jolson and Streisand and Miss Dangette and Sinatra sing the music, we can all do what we can to reconcile the colossal contradictions inherent in the lives of those colossal finaglers, Lee and J.J. Schubert, each of whom had a philosophy admirably summed up by the words of one of the songs that they commissioned.
I'll go my way by myself, like walking under a cloud. I'll go my way by myself, all alone in a crowd. I'll try to apply myself and teach my heart how to sing. I'll go my way by myself, like a bird on the wing. I'll face the unknown. I'll build a world of my own. No one knows.
Benny Green was talking about the Schubert brothers in next week's American Showman. The producer for the series is David Raven Allen.